So today I'm sitting in the house of James Honger here in Burlingame in California. And James is the founder of Hot or Not, which is kind of a revolution for a lot of us on the internet because it's one of the first companies that totally self-funded and made it themselves online. And so they started out of the houses and grew to quite a lot of scale and then sold. James has got a good story. We're actually sitting here drinking tea. And it's a good thing. So James, take it away. Tell us about yourself.
Okay. What can I tell you? I mean, do you want to...
Tell us a little bit about your background, what people have.
Okay, sure. My background is... I guess I've been online since I was in third grade when I got my first modem, which was a 300 baud modem. And, I kind of grew up on DBSs and down, cracking games, downloading software, and,
What were you cracking games with?
Huh? Well, mostly on Attle 2. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it was just, playing with the byte code on the disk and stuff like that. With disk editors and stuff. And, those were back in the day of, Ultima 2 and things like that. And got a modem when I was in fifth grade. Got really into BBSs and, downloading software and freaking credit card stuff.
Are you doing Blue Ultima?
I was, at that time I was in sixth grade. I tried to make one, but it didn't work. But back in the day of the blue boxes and all the different color boxes, which isn't always how Apple started.
Right.
How
Apple started?
When they got together, they were making...
I know they were telling them, but that's how Apple started.
I mean, that's how Wozniak and Jobs, that's what they were working on before they...
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think Jobs wanted to buy one or something like that, and that's how they met. One of them wanted to buy it, and the other one knew how to make them. And, So I've been online for a long time, and, I went to Berkeley, got engineering, electrical engineering, computer science degree, and, so I just basically, I like to play online, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I think that seems to be a common theme with a lot of people who build web companies in kind of my generation. A lot of people were online very early, and so I kind of bounced around. I got a real job after college, worked at HP, building test equipment, that kind of scientific stuff, and I was always so fascinated with the web, and after I left HP, I went to business school for a couple of years and decided I just wanted to get back into stuff I really loved to play with, which was the internet. And so then I started Hot or Not a year after business school, and that was an interesting experience. We just kind of, at the time, we were really interested in web services and things like that, and Dave Weiner, I don't know Dave Weiner, but he's kind of like software industry pundit, and he had this concept of the two-way web, is it the phrase that he coined, and the two-way web was basically pointing out that the difference between the internet medium and traditional mediums is the fact that conversations can happen, that feedback is really easy, that the flow of content can go in both directions, not just in one, which is the case in print and TV and so on. And so that was really interesting to us. And so when we came up with Hot or Not, we were basically trying to think of things that we thought could be viral, or at least not viral in the strict sense of viral, which, to be strictly viral, you have to, as part of using the product, the user has to pass it on to someone else. So we were not viral with Hot or Not, but we just thought it had strong word of mouth. And the concept was basically that, someone would submit their picture to the site for other people to rate, and people would rate the picture and see the score. And then
so you went on to that concept because you thought it would be viral.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of funny that before we did Hot or Not, I was obsessed with this guy called Turkish Stud.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Turkish Stud?
Yeah,
so I kiss you, my hero. Yeah, I mean, I was a huge fan of him. I had the computer screensaver and the t-shirt. And basically, the reason I was obsessed with him was because somehow this dude, who turned out didn't even make the website, someone else took his website and made a joke website out of it, ended up on Letterman. And he got a million people come to his site, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what they say anyway. I mean, I think eTor, the company eTor, I don't know if you remember that. They really tried to write him and they brought him out here and put publicity behind him. But, I was young and naive at the time. I didn't realize that. So I was pretty fascinated by the fact that I was talking to my business partner, Jim Young, my co-founder of Hot or Not, we were just man, that is just insane that this dude, by himself with no funding, got this many people to check his site out, right? And that was just amazing to me. I guess now today people understand the potential of the scale of the internet, and back then it was still fairly new. It seemed like the only people who were able to achieve that kind of scale were well-funded companies who had a lot of press and blah, blah, blah. And not just this, that was the first time I saw a person get that kind of distribution organically, or at least seemingly organically. And so we kind of had a challenge. I said, dude, we have to build them here. So when we launched Hot or Not, it was actually it was not intended to be a business. It was more just we just wanted to build them here. And without any thought of the consequences of building them here or the cost structure or whatnot at the time. So
you want to build them here and you want it to be viral.
Well, we realized that, viral marketing, word of mouth marketing are the only ways that you can grow to that size without spending for it.
Right.
Either you're buying it or people are giving it to you.
Right.
And we were broke, so we were trying to get people to give it to us. So when we came up with the concept of Hot or Not, it was kind of based around the idea of voyeurism and looking at girls or looking at guys, which we felt was pretty compelling, and we thought it would have potential for becoming the hero. And so, and it was, the concept was so simple that it didn't take that long for us to build. And so we had the idea 1 week. We Jim coded most of it in a week.
So in reality, in a couple of days. Was it your problem with the build program?
Yeah, in the beginning, yeah. It was always Jim doing the programming. I think I might have like started the database schema in the very beginning, which I'm sure he wiped out by the end of that week. But so Jim did all the coding. It was just an idea that we had. And Jim was busy doing his PhD at the time, and he was kind of burned out, so he wanted a side project to work on as a break. And again, the intention was just kind of see what would happen. We had a feeling that it could be popular, but we didn't know, so we just kind of wanted to throw it out there and see what would happen. So we launched a week later, and all I did was I emailed it to 42 of my friends. I think we launched it on a Monday around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and by the end of the day, we had like 30,000 visitors, 37,000 visitors or something.
On the first day?
Yeah, on the first day. Like, within the half day, on the first half day, really. And yeah, I mean, it basically turned out that, like, you know, at the time, there's nothing else going on. You know, it's October of 2000, so the downturn had already happened, and people were kind of, like, in a numb state at the mind. And so nothing was happening in those days. And so I think just the concept of it and the fact that it was a two-way conversation, in our opinion. Like, when we built the product, the thinking was, hey, you know, it's not just me posting my photo for people to see, which was in and of itself kind of a novel concept at the time. The idea that I would submit a picture or content that for strangers to look at was totally novel, as far as we knew. You know, Blogger and LiveJournal and those kind of things were starting to get popular. And you could, you know, I'm not sure if those, you would have strangers looking at your content on Blogger and LiveJournal, but it wasn't expressly for that purpose. You know, so like this was pure exhibitionism and pure voyeurism. And when you submit your photo, that's like a communication. You're giving content to these other people, and when they vote and give you a score back, that we felt was like a communication back.
Right.
So it was kind of like, you know, early in the days of user-generated content and conversations, of this two-way web notion. So in that way, like, it was fairly new, many of the concepts that underlie this product. So, and it was simple. And it was, you didn't really have to explain it to anyone. So that's why we felt like, oh, maybe this could be our mature. And so we booked it and sent it to 40 people. 37,000 people came by the first day.
So those 40 people just handled the whole thing.
Yeah. So like, and we didn't even tell them to. All the email said was like, it was a link to my picture on the my picture on the site, and you know, saying, hey, here's something Jim and I built. Just be nice when you vote for me. And that was it. And
they weren't voting on you, so they went on and started uploading photos of that.
Yeah. So
you know, I'm sure people consider you a handsome guy, but I don't think
right. So the interesting thing is, like, so we seeded the site with maybe 100 pictures of other people.
Right.
I think we took them from some dating website or some random place where I could get pictures of people. So they were rating those people. Then people started signing up. More people started coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the day, we had, you know, I think like 100 new pictures uploaded.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we were like, okay, we don't need the fake pictures anymore.
Right.
So we deleted them.
Right.
And from that point on, it was all real. And so that's kind of what happened. And so it just kept growing on its own. And by the end of the week, we had about, we broke 1 million page views a day on the 8th day. And I think we had like 1.8 million page views that day. I think the day before we had 900,000. So it was like doubled on that day.
So you knew you had a model in hand.
I mean, within the first day, I mean, the thing was 40,000 people. And it was like growing really fast. So interestingly enough, a few things happened that really jump-started the growth. One was that Salon.com wrote about it the day after we launched. And I don't know if you remember Salon.
Yeah, I might have actually even read that at the time.
Yeah, it was.
But I didn't think you were like an out of the wall.
Yeah, we were. It literally, I talked to Janelle Brown, the writer, the day we launched.
Hmm.
Or is that right? I'm thinking about that. It might have been one. No, it was the next day. So I guess it was written 2 days after we launched.
Hmm.
I need to go back and look at the date to be sure. But the funny thing was that Janelle was actually the person who wrote about Mahir and became big too.
Right.
So but it was a total coincidence. The other coincidence was that I went to college with Janelle and we were next door neighbors in the dorm.
Right.
It was kind of funny because I didn't recognize my friend who sent it to her, and subsequently she contacted me through. He didn't tell me her last name. He just said, my friend Janelle wants to write an article about you guys. And so I didn't know who she was. And we were anonymous at the time. So we said, well, I don't want her to know who I am. So just give her my number, but I'm not going to tell her who I am.
Right.
And so halfway through the interview, she was just rating people. And she just kind of stopped. She's like, is this James Hong? And I was like, oh my God, like what? Like, how do you know? And she's like, it's Janelle Brown. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't realize. Like, I've been talking to my old college neighbor.
Well, well.
But yeah, it is a small world. But so she wrote the story the day after or the day after that, after lunch. And so she wrote an article in Salon.com, which got a lot more people, you know, then hit Slashdot and things like that. And then by the end of the week, we were in most major European papers.
Because that was, I mean, I've got a little question for you. So that was one of the things that really drove it forward. You really pushed PR.
Oh, yeah.
So you had a viral model, but you worked PR. And so your role in the company was what? Your PR guy?
Yeah, so basically at that point, Jim was doing all the coding. He was trying to make it scale. I was doing all the any business development, and I was doing all the PR. Because we basically felt like what we had was something that had a lot of word-of-mouth potential,
right.
but was not entirely defensible from a technology standpoint or even concept standpoint. We didn't patent it, so it was on because we launched.
Right.
And so we basically came to the conclusion that the only way that we could really grow and survive was if there were two classes of competitors that we saw could potentially knock us out. One is another startup who somehow out-executed us, or a big company that had distribution already, right? And so for the big companies that had distribution already, we kind of wrote them off for the time being because we figured any big company who's public is not going to want to start Hotter Not, because at the time it was regarded as so edgy that, you know, it's like, is this porn?
Right.
It would come up. And so, we were not worried about them. And with the startups, we were worried about them. And, you know, like true porn, like within a week, there was you know, like probably 100 copycats.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very quick. In fact, like within a month, there was a category on Yahoo called Am I X or Not? And, you know, it's like just like different copycats.
A month after you saw it?
Yeah. And because it's a very simple concept. It takes, you know, in reality, it took Jim 2 days of coding.
Your main thing that drove the software was PR? Is that how you stayed ahead of everyone?
That is how. So what we realized was that we saw it as going through word of mouth, but PR people are just people who happen to have a million friends,
right,
that they can tell about it to. And so the strategy was, if we got that press first, then we would lock out any competitor from getting press because no writer wants to write a story that's already been written. And they certainly don't want to write the same story twice themselves.
Yeah.
So the goal was for me to get as much traffic, as much PR as we can, to get as much seeds for this virality out there as possible.
Yeah.
And Jim, in the meantime, would continue working on scaling the site to keep up with that traffic. And, except for some BD that I did in the beginning. I did a deal with Rackspace that covered our costs. So we didn't pay for servers for a long time.
That was probably a good one to do.
We almost wanted to shut the site down because the site cost so much money at the time to run.
What was the deal with them?
Basically, they would, you know, the whole managed service model was fairly new at the time,
right.
And they were the leader in this space, but it was still fairly small. And so, basically, I went to them and said, "Listen, we're like a perfect poster child for you guys because it's like, well, look, we have no upfront money." So, like, working with you is like amortizing the cost of service without needing the money up front to buy from Dell or whatever. You have the ability for us to scale on quickly because you have machines already, whereas if we ordered the machines, it would take weeks to get.
Right.
And we need to scale now. So, basically, said, look, we can be your poster child for why scaling internet applications quickly makes most sense on managed hosts, not on doing it yourself.
Mm.
And they believe that. And I also said, hey, and by the way, I have an interview with the Wall Street Journal, I have an interview with CNET Radio tomorrow. Like, you want me to, and I can talk about it.
Right.
So, to them, it was that we were a good poster child for them, and that we were getting a lot of
publicity. Them all.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm still friends with a lot of their founders, and
is that Richard? You?
Yeah, friends with Richard.
Hmm.
And Lou Mormon, the person who did the deal, and he's still there. And you know, like, I think, you know, we were part of their early history. Obviously, they did a good job and they had a great product, so they would have made it on their own. But I like to think that
what you're doing a long time ago. So that's it. Yeah, I probably heard that Rackspace for you back then.
Yeah, we put Rackspace's logo on our site, next, you know, above the fold.
What do you think that would have cost you back in the beginning?
Oh, well, the bandwidth alone back then it was about $1,000 per megabit per second.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it probably would have cost us about $1 million a month or something like that. At that cost level, you know, like we pushed close to 100 megabits per second.
How did you thought it was worth that kind of exposure? Because that must have cost a lot.
So this is before I did the deal with them. It was going to cost us about 100. So we were pushing about 100 megabits per second, and so at $1,000 per meg, that'd be $100,000 a month. $1 million a year, but we were broke, so that was not, you know, even a tenth of that was not acceptable.
Right.
No, we actually pushed most of the cost to Yahoo.
By hosting the photos together?
Yeah, so we basically stopped hosting photos and started telling people to go to GeoCities and open an account to and give us the URL of the photo on GeoCities, and we'll just put that, you know, that URL in HTML.
What did they say about that?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that a month later, Yahoo shut down the ability for people to do that,
right.
But they whitelisted us.
Huh.
And a year later, I had to call them up and ask them to do something for us, and in the process of talking to them, I said, hey, listen, I want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but you know, can you tell me why?
Right.
Why you did that? Like, you know, thank you, but why? And he basically said, look, we just didn't want to be the guys who killed Hotter Not, because we loved it.
Oh,
yeah, so it was just, it was basically Google.
Hmm.
And so we were hosted on Yahoo, on GeoCities, all the images for a good year's time.
So you had to be great to help you get going.
Yeah, Rackspace. Well, yeah, not only that, there was a third one, which was that, so Yahoo made it so the hosting of the pictures was free for us, but what we realized was that we needed to make money to make it sustainable.
Right.
And because, you know, the free ones can last forever. And so we ended up going to Ophoto as well. Mm-hmm. And this is in the very, very early days of their affiliate program. And we basically said, hey, will you do an affiliate deal with us? So we basically said to new users, hey, if you don't have a camera, just take your picture. And, you know, back then most people didn't have cameras, so they got pictures from their friend who had a camera.
Right.
So back then it was like, if you don't have a camera, go to Yahoo GeoCities. If you do have a camera, go to Ophoto. And Ophoto, so they posted photos of those users for us, and they paid us $1 per user.
Oh, right.
And so we made, so that was interesting. We took something that was going to be our biggest cost driver and turned it into a profit center. So that was quite nice. And so, yeah, but those three were probably our biggest breaks that made a difference between us succeeding and not succeeding.
Because now, today, that wouldn't be an issue of those things, but back when you did it, you were right on that cusp
right.
That was hard.
The ratio of cost is probably, of bandwidth is probably 100 to 1.
I mean, it almost shouldn't have been possible what you did, and I guess it was probably because of the tricks
you got
there.
Yeah, if it weren't for those tricks, we certainly could not have done it without raising money. And, yeah, like I said, it was $1,000 per megabit per second, and today you can get it for about 10 or less. So, quite a bit difference, you know, and the machine costs are different now, too, so... yeah, building a Hana application today would be trivial in terms of cost structure, but so not on the not back then.
In your first year, how much of your time is on PR?
Well, we started the first. I would say
as a percentage, 80% of your time, 50%.
Probably about 75 to 80%.
75 to 80% of your time on PR.
Yeah. Of the time, I would say 75 to 80% of the time that I worked. I wouldn't say that I was necessarily working full time.
Right.
No, we were kind of, it was kind of a lifestyle at that point, and so you know we worked some of the time, not all the time.
Why are you working that hard?
Well, in the beginning, we were working pretty hard. But it tapered off once we, you know, the press probably lasted really strong for about half a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, which is pretty remarkable, actually. Like, now that I understand how the press works, the fact that we were getting press for that long is actually quite remarkable. Because most things don't get press for that long.
Right.
They just kind of come and go. But a few things get press for a long time. You know, like, when you look at Twitter now, Twitter's going, like, well beyond half a year.
Right.
And Facebook did as well, and so did MySpace. We were kind of in between there, and, you know, most people get, like, for one article. You know, there are five articles, and then they pay the PR person, you know, $20,000, and thank you very much, and that's it.
Right.
So I was working on press most of the time, and then the rest of the time I was, like, you know, doing the various Rackspace deals, and then Jim and I worked on the product together, like, kind of.
And were you in school, or was it
No, just post-school. So Jim was still a grad student.
So are you ever going to be able to work out again, or have you just been, like, you've had this lifestyle businesses?
Yeah, you know, I don't think, I don't think so. I think, I don't think for me, and I don't think for most people up here, or for most entrepreneurs, I don't think the motivation is the excitement and the adrenaline of doing something cool and building something that a lot of people can use and that basically build you street cred. Like when we first started Hana, the motivation is not to make money either. It was actually just to build street cred and just because we wanted to build money here. But we worked our asses off. I mean, I think like it doesn't matter if you have money or you don't have money. If you have something that is taking off like crazy, you're gonna work really hard on it because it's fun, right? And it's like an adrenaline rush. And you know, the first week I probably slept about 8 hours the whole week. Not
pretty
night. I was up. I was slept maybe an hour a night, and it was just because I couldn't stop thinking about the site. I couldn't stop thinking about things I should do. And
you're like,
you're
on that one.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I remember when we launched it. Jim and I had a conversation very, very early on, the first night, and we basically agreed that we didn't know how, but we knew that this was like a life changing event. And it's kind of definitely turned out to be true.
Yeah.
But at the time, we just thought the life-changing event would be that we would not have street cred.
So you could, like, go and get venture capital and start a company. Mm-hmm. Is that what you thought?
For something else, yeah.
and then you made your Ophoto deal, and then money started coming in to, like, well...
Well, no, but the Ophoto deal kind of, like, tidied us over, but, like, but we saw how advertising was shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that advertising was not going to be a sustainable model anytime soon.
Right.
And so then we created the dating part of the site, and then threw in the revenue model there, which was subscription-based.
Right.
And, you know, actually, the interesting thing is we had no real... idea how well it would monetize, but it ended up monetizing very well, over 15%. By the time we sold the company, you know, it's optimized over time. Mm-hmm. It was converting about 15% of, or over 50% of new dating site users would end up paying, which it's pretty good. They were paying $6 a month at the time,
mm-hmm.
Which we felt was just kind of like an impulse buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
did you test different price points?
You know, we didn't. We just felt comfortable with $6 because it was based on what we thought 2 beers would cost in a bar. Subsequently, like 5 years later, we did price testing because we felt like 2 years the price went up. And we did the price testing and it showed that $8 was the right price.
Mm-hmm.
But that's right. But then we actually never implemented it. And then when we sold the company, they implemented it. And true to form, it was inelastic. The demand is still
the
same.
So you left a lot of money on the table.
We did leave money on the table.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
so,
yeah, like in a sense, maybe we got soft in that regard because why did we not just implement it right away? But you know what? Actually, the real motivation for that was that we knew that the utility of making more money was not worth as much to us as the sure money that we were going to get at $6 a month. So we basically didn't want to fuck with it.
Right.
If we touch this machine if we change the machine too much, it could destroy it, and we don't know that we can rebuild it.
Right.
Because, you know, like I think that is skill, and like, but we were really lucky. And right. So, like, and there's less price, like, I don't know. So, right. So we were fairly conservative with the company and monetization, because we knew that if we just ran it for like 5 years, we would both make enough money that we wouldn't have to ever get jobs.
Right.
And so that was actually kind of like what made us really risk averse. Hmm. But getting back to the, do we think that we, am I soft now? I don't think so. I mean, I think I personally obsess about things as a matter of personality.
Hmm.
And I think for them as well, it's just like, it's adrenaline, it's making something cool.
But how, I mean, other than those, you started that in 2000?
Yeah.
So during the 8 years that you ran it, how hard were you working?
Not that hard. Honestly, like, the first year was hard.
Solid 10-hour week.
In the beginning was a solid, 24 times 7 minus 8. Right? In terms of, the first half year was a lot of work in terms of time.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we got the revenue model working. It started making us, the first year, I think we ended up earning about, $700,000 to
$800,000. Mm-hmm.
At the point we turned the model on, we're like, okay, this more than pays for our salaries.
Right.
So as long as we can just kind of keep it going, it's cool. And so at that point, we didn't have to work as hard. And, Jim and I were never really that hard workers. We're capable of hard work, but in bursts. And so we just kind of did what we needed to maintain it at our own pace.
Mm.
And, we're probably working, like, Jim was still working on CHD, so, we were working probably 10 hours a week each.
So you posted this before I work late.
10-hour weeks. I work about 2 hours a day on weekdays,
right.
Doing after the PR diet and all that stuff. Besides working with Jim, it was just mostly doing PR. The reality was, we work on it 10 hours a week, but mentally we work on it 24 hours a day.
Right.
It's your baby, so like you're always thinking about it. And like we were roommates, and so in our office was our living room, so we were always on it.
What were you doing the rest of the time?
We were drinking a lot. We were going to parties and stuff like that. I mean, we were basically living the lifestyle business life
right.
that you would live if you were in your
20s. Right.
Unfortunately, it was our late 20s and our early 20s.
Right.
Well, probably fortunately, it was our late 20s and our early 20s. Right. I can only imagine what it would have been like if we were younger. So it was probably less crazy than it would have been. But we were basically just kind of hanging out. We liked to go to cafes, so we'd go to the cafe every day. And we had friends who lived in our neighborhood that also worked from home, so we had kind of our neighborhood gang that would go to lunch every day. Mm. It's kind of like, it was the equivalent of, what it was like? It was basically like summer school for a kid.
Right.
It's like, we had to work maybe like 10 hours a week, including homework and class. But then the rest of the time, we would go out and hang out with our friends and go out and play. So I don't think that really made us soft in that, like I said, it's the adrenaline I think that most entrepreneurs are going for.
Right.
And even if you're motivated by money or whatever in the beginning to get started, and I'm not going to lie, money is probably one of the goals. But I think if you experience hypergrowth on anything, just adrenaline kicks in and it's like a rush.
Right.
And it's very much of a, when things like that happen, it's usually make it or break it for the whole company like in that first month.
Right.
Because you're either going to pull it off and scale or you're not.
Right.
And so that's just like an exciting adventure.
And you have nothing to lose. Oh, yeah.
And we have nothing to lose.
And so you guys started yourself $700,000 or $800,000 in the first year. And can you talk about in terms of revenues?
It built up to probably about $7.5 million revenue.
Every year.
It ramped up to that level.
With almost no cost.
No cost. So for the first 3 years, it was just Jim and I working out of the house.
Right.
And then we realized, at some point, we came to the realization, Jim started really getting into motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of had a conversation once where it was like, if you die,
you're going to find a bus.
It's not a good thing. And we had never heard of D&O insurance or anything like that. And
right.
D&O insurance wouldn't have covered like the loss of the running of the site. So, basically, that's when we decided to hire some people. And so we ramped up a steady state of maybe 3 to 4 coders and a customer service person / office manager. And we had like 4 or 5 salaries. And
which doesn't make a big
difference. No. I mean, our net margin was probably in the, varied over time, but like, I think probably 80%.
And then you had a $20 million exit.
Yeah, $20 million exit at the end was, it was slightly more than that, but that was basically just gravy in our minds, because we were basically, after 8 years of running the company, and being basically 24/7 mentally on hard or not, we were just tired.
Right.
And we had made enough money over the previous 8 years that, honestly, like whatever price we could get for it was fine.
Right.
I remember telling my wife at the time, my wife at the time, when she was my girlfriend, I remember telling her, like, if someone were willing to just take it for free, I'd probably give it to them if I thought that they could do a good job with it. Because it was, the goal of Hot or Not financially for us was to achieve financial stability and security such that we would be able to work on startup the rest of our lives.
Right.
And that's how we kind of viewed it, and that's how we booked it. And, arguably, we could have made a lot more money on Hot or Not, even just by charging $8 instead of
$6. Mm.
But the goal was really just to get us to that point of stability. And so, we just, when it came time to sell it, it was just like, let's just get rid of it.
Did you call it slow?
Do I think that we could have gotten a higher price if we shopped it harder?
Yeah.
Like, we didn't shop it at all,
right.
Definitely. Yeah, probably. But I don't know how much higher, and I don't know what the percentage risk was of no deal happening at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Jim and I already made our goal, so it's almost like we didn't really care.
Right.
Especially if you put it into the context of, you know, one of our friends, actually the YouTube founders, Steve Chen and then their first engineer, Mike Solomon, actually almost joined us before they started YouTube to start a social network around media sharing. And, so Jim was very close friends with Steve, and we would see Steve at the cafe because we were in Mountain View, which is where PayPal was, and we were right down the street from PayPal. And so we used to all go to the same cafe. And, basically, Steve's objective in the beginning of YouTube, or of any startup that he wanted to do, was basically to achieve a lifestyle business.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't actually trying to build a $1 billion business,
right.
But he kind of like picked the right idea and ran well with it. The point is that, I just lost my train of thought because I was flattering so much about Steve. I had a point about Steve.
Not a problem, I've got plenty more questions.
What was the question first?
Yeah, I'm going to. We were talking about the exercise and...
Oh, right. The thing that we learned from watching Steve was that, they went from zero to $1.5 billion in a year and a half.
Right.
So it's kind of like, well, are we going to build Hot or Not into a $1.5 billion business? Probably not.
Right.
So we could continue working on it, but there would be an opportunity cost of potentially like $1.5 billion.
Right.
Or some mega win.
On something else.
And the fact is that because we were working on it for so long, our heart was not in it as much. Because both Jim and I typically have typical ADD personalities. So the reality is, if it was going to happen, it would have already happened for us a long time ago.
Right.
And it's not to say that it couldn't be a much bigger business, but we were probably not going to be the ones to do it.
Mm.
So why would, we could stay collecting checks that would not have a marginal utility to us.
Right.
If I had, an extra $1 million a year or something like that, it's like it's not going to make the biggest difference to my lifestyle. The next job has to be much bigger. And we weren't going to achieve that doing this. So in our minds, the opportunity cost was selling it for less price was probably worth more to us than that money. And so...
Now, one of the reasons you gave at the time when you sold was the spam shoot. Now, I was really interested in that because, and so this relates to something else. There's a site, because as you know, I live in the Caribbean, and so there's a site called Sexy or Not.
Yeah, Sexy or Not, yeah.
Which I guess is a knockoff.
Oh, is it? It's fascinating. Like, we had so many ripoffs, and we used to really enjoy looking at all the ripoffs and saying, man, these guys are not going to make it because they changed this or they changed that. Because we did put a lot of thought into our product.
Mm-hmm.
Sexy or Not was smart in that. Their first rev was an exact copy of our site. Like, they didn't change anything.
Right.
And
knockoff style.
Yeah, because like for most of the knockoffs, we could point to something that he did, and we're like, okay, that's gonna destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
The most common one was people wanted to add ability for people to comment on photos.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew what would happen. You get like really lewd comments, or you get really mean comments,
right.
Which means other people who are reading those comments are not gonna want to submit their pictures because they don't want to submit themselves to, they submit themselves to the number, but they don't want to hear like you're a phony bitch,
right?
Sexy O'No is one of the more successful copycats.
So they've done well.
Yeah.
And then,
are they still running it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they're still running. And so when you guys, one of the reasons you wanted to get out was the spam issue, like they haven't had problems with spam.
Oh, no. It wasn't so much, I think we didn't get out because of the spam issue, but we knew that the spam was becoming a bigger problem and that we would have to spend a lot of time and energy fighting it,
mm-hmm.
And which I'm sure they've done.
What do you mean by spam?
People from other countries, there are two
options. I'm Olga from
Nigerian, can you wire me money? That type of thing, typically,
mm-hmm.
Right? The scammers are actually very well organized. And in fact, it's funny, like, they would often, some of them would often use the same password on Hot or Not that they would use on their email accounts that they were using to offer.
Right.
So when we identified a spam account, we started doing research to understand what they were doing. And it was, one of them was a very sophisticated operation out of the Philippines it was like a call center. Like, they had level one people, level two people who would escalate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one person, they would have a bot that would do things, and then someone would start engaging you.
Right.
And then if it looked like you were a hot lead, they would escalate you to a next level person who could close the money or something.
That's not the right way to do it.
Yeah, and it was very professionally run. And so finding these guys is not impossible, but it was going to be a lot of work.
And so they're doing all that as lead gen on HotOrNot.com.
Yes. Lead gen for them getting you to send the money, mm-hmm. Not lead gen for a product.
I never understood really what you meant by spam.
Yeah. It's fraudsters, basically.
Yeah.
It's a Nigerian scam over a dating site instead of email.
Yeah, right.
It's not that we sold because the problem was so bad that it couldn't be solved. It's because we realized that the amount of, to solve it, we would have to come back in and work really hard on a system that we were kind of tired of working on.
Got it.
And so that's what I meant by by spam problem being one of the reasons that we...
So one of the things you guys did that I thought was pretty clever was this, you got a team of volunteers to help you run the site. And so you had the slogan of fun, clean, and real.
Fun, clean, and real, right. Actually, YouTube used it well after.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that? You got an army of guys to basically do your work for you.
Yeah. So what we realized is that in the beginning when we launched the site, we also added a forum.
Mm-hmm.
I think we actually had one of the largest Yahoo clubs, or what were they called back then? Yahoo clubs? I think it was clubs. I can't remember. Anyway, Yahoo had a bulletin board system. And we created one, and it was fairly large, and the user base inside it was very active. And so when we first started thinking of ways that we could monetize, we thought, okay, well, we'll go with advertising as the lowest hanging fruit. But then we talked to the founder of DoubleClick early on and asked him for advice. And he said, look, if you're going to have advertising, you're going to have to be able to guarantee that there's not going to be a naked picture on the site.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, how do we deal with that? So the first thing we did was we built a system for Gemini to look at pictures and redact them.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of made a we basically, his words made us shift the model from pictures being innocent until proven guilty to guilty until proven innocent. It had to be moderated before it showed up on the site. So we did that for about a day and realized that wasn't going to work out because we were too busy. And so then we enlisted my parents to do it. My parents were, you know, my dad was newly retired,
right.
And so they were just hanging out at home. And so they started moderating pictures. And a few days after they did that, I called them and said, how are things going? And my dad was like, oh, you know, it's really interesting. You know, Mom saw some really interesting pictures, and he started describing them. And I'm like, and I told him, I'm like, you can't have my parents looking at porn all day. So,
I'm sorry, I should not. That's really funny.
So then we said, well, what can we do? And he said, well, why don't we have our community do it?
Right.
And so we came up with a fun, clean, and real tagline because we felt like it was kind of like a call to action or something that they could gel around.
Right.
To say, the interesting thing was that, like, it was not hard even then to, like, find porn on the web.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, to some of these people, it was, like, a mission to try and keep at least one place clean.
Right.
Right? We were, like, the well-lit corner of the CD web.
I remember back in when you guys were, 7 years ago or 6 years ago, I emailed with some of the guys. I found them on the forums and emailed them, because I couldn't understand what they were doing. And it felt like they had a mission. They really wanted to keep all clean.
A lot of them were people who, they were in a community. And when people are in a community, they care about the community. They care about each other. You know, just like any other, it's just socializing, right? It's like, it's human nature for you to care about the group that you're active in. Just like, it's just like team behavior. Like,
did they know you were making a fortune of it?
No, at that time they didn't know. They didn't know, but the reality is we were very timid about it, but when we finally revealed it, they were happy.
Hmm.
Because then it's kind of like the thing that they're part of was a success.
Hmm.
Right? Which kind of surprises, but now looking back on it and thinking about what I'm saying, it makes sense because people want to be on a winning team. And people care about that more than they care about money, in fact.
Hmm. Right?
And that's why people buy virtual goods on communities. Like, the places where people are going to make the most money selling virtual bits are places where people care how they look to other people, and they care how they look to other people when they interact with them more.
Right.
Right. So it's like
that's what Facebook has now.
And that's what Facebook has now, right? Like, that's why Facebook is so powerful, because it friends you, and that's why you care about. And in general, that's social networking. That's why people care about the social networking profile, because they want to look cool to their friends.
Yeah.
And the mods, they were a part of this community, and because they were part of the community, and they were spending so much time talking to each other. This gave them another way to be deeper in this community. And most of these people were doing it from work, and they were in isolated jobs. We had a lot of admins and disc jockeys and even some investment bankers who, investment banking is a lot of work, but a lot of it is actually FaceTime. They're just sitting at the office waiting for documents to come back from, the legal team or something like that. And so,
how many moderators did you have?
We had thousands.
Thousands of moderators. So if you had to pay all the team, it would have been another massive cost.
Yeah, absolutely. And people were paying for that functionality, like FriendFinder and all the other dating sites. To this day, I may even pay for that functionality. And what we found was that using a wisdom, the crowds type technique, that the efficiency and the accuracy of the system was quite strong.
You guys, it seems like you just did everything right. I mean, this is...
I think, I mean that's
you obviously got lucky.
Who knows? We got lucky, and who's to say that we couldn't have done... things turned out well, so things look great in retrospect. But, but who knows what it could have been if we'd done things differently. Maybe it would have been better. But, it's just like people say eBay is doing great, but maybe it would be better and even bigger if they were doing their thing.
So you've hooked on a lot of
we solved some problems in ways that were unorthodox at the time, but today are more commonly accepted and known. So user generated content, the concept of two way communication of the content, and virtual goods. I think we were the first interesting site in the U.S. to do virtual goods back in 2004, selling virtual flowers. And the concept of wisdom of crowds was not known then, but that's technically what Hot or Not was, and that's also what our moderation system was. So what we realized is that it was based on the math, the moderation system, that even if someone only has a 5% accuracy, if you require five people to say a vote in favor of a picture, then the odds of getting five negative votes or getting five wrong votes is 1 minus 5% to fifth power.
Mm-hmm.
So it quickly becomes, 99.999% system. That was kind of that was an interesting thing that came up with. And then it was very interesting to read Wisdom of Crowds to understand what we had done. And it helped us understand what we did even better as well. It's not like we invented it. And it's not like Sarah Wiggy invented it, the author. This kind of thing has been going on in communities all the time.
You know? Yeah, you guys just did a lot of things really quickly.
And the internet is really, that's really what the internet changes, is that it enables communities to form. And, you know, and kind of like Web 1.0, it was about community formation. And then Web 2.0 started being more about, okay, with this network, what can you do now that you couldn't do before?
Right?
Like, now that you have this distribution, now let's start flowing content over it. Now let's start doing intelligent observations based on that content, right? Like hot or not, like Yelp. You know, all sorts of things, right? Like, but Yelp is not new, like Zagat existed, but it only existed in book form, so it was slow and not everyone could participate. It was edited to some degree and so on. And the web is like the ultimate opening of community action. And that kind of stuff did happen on BBSs, but just on a minor scale, because the only people on BBSs or, you know, on Usenet were, you know, dorks like me.
Right.
Whereas now everyone
can. Like me.
Yeah.
You guys had the domain, you started off with Am I Hot or Not?
Yeah.
And you switched to Hot or Not?
Yeah.
How did that work? Like, how that's the question.
That's actually what we use all the Ofoto money for.
Oh, really?
It's kind of funny. So when we started Hot or Not, the original name was going to be CanYouTakeIt.net, which just shows the naivete of Gemini at the time.
Right.
It's like .net, like nothing, yeah. Nothing .net has ever worked.
Right.
You know, crazy.org is probably the, you know, most interesting word. But so when we started Hot or Not, we looked at different names, and we actually did look at Am I Hot? Am I Hot or Not? We looked at Hot or Not, but it was taken.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't find anything on the site. Am I Hot or Not was only when I was in Taken, so we launched on that. And then my understanding of what happened is that, like, Howard Stern was talking about our site, like, in that, you know, first week.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing we know, there's a site on amihot.com. And then a month later, we get a cease and desist from them saying that we launched after them.
Mm-hmm.
And which we knew not to be true, because we went to their site and their site was down. And their reply to that was, well, we had to move the server, so you must have just caught it when it was offline,
mm-hmm.
which we didn't really buy, but whatever they, you know, we didn't want this legal action, because at that point, we didn't even think it was a company.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked out with them that we said, okay, look, we're going to get hotornot.com, and we'll move from amihotornot to hotornot. And it turns out later that, like, we found out from someone who interned at the company that they really thought that they were screwing us by doing that deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because they felt like amihotornot, everyone would abbreviate to amihot, and that they would basically win and we would lose. But as soon as that happened, I basically reoriented all the press to being Hot or Not. And
sure, it is your name.
Well, yes, and yeah, which is what we like, and it rhymed, you know. And
that's it.
But the press was so
Hot versus Hot or Not.
Yes.
Hot or Not, it totally rhymes. It's like simple,
yeah,
back there.
Yeah, yeah, it's catchier, and little things like that matter.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of people ask us why we thought Hot or Not was a success, and I had two reasons. One was the name, and the other was because of the JavaScript auto-submit thing that we did, where if you, back then, all form posts, people would have to hit a submit button,
mm-hmm.
and we came up with a JavaScript to make it just go,
right.
And which made the interface a lot more addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things probably made us, from a product standpoint. But, you know, like...
So, was it your idea, or was it your
The JavaScript was my idea. Hot or Not, I mean, we worked on together. Well, the JavaScript thing was an idea of Jim Fear. Basically, I said, dude, can we get that? Can that exist?
Right.
Back then, JavaScript was fairly new. No one used it.
Right.
And we had a lot of clever things with JavaScript, actually. Another problem that we had is people would get the picture approved, and then they would change, but because it was distributed on GOCs, they would change the picture after it was approved.
Mm-hmm.
So we did this thing where when they submit the photo, we took a hash of the photo. We took dimensions and the file size and things like that. We didn't do a hash because but we did do a file size and dimensions,
mm-hmm.
because i.e. Internet Explorer allowed JavaScript to access those functions, those characteristics in browser.
Right.
So what we would do is, when we displayed a photo on any given page, we had JavaScript code checking to see that the file size and dimensions of the picture were exactly the same as what was in our database for that, mm-hmm. for that image. And if it wasn't, it would automatically go to the next page. It would send to our server a request saying, hey, give me another picture. And by the way, this one is bad now.
Right.
And then that one would go back into the queue,
mm-hmm.
The moderation queue.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, I remember reading an interview with you somewhere about which talked about everything was very efficient.
Yeah.
Three pages, very efficient.
Yeah, so we basically tried to automate wherever we could, and that was basically a function of the fact that it was just two guys, and we didn't have employees, and we were running lean.
Right.
And I think if we raised money, things would probably work out a lot differently.
Yeah,
we really made the thing pretty efficient in the first, you know, in the beginning of the site. But
do you think it helped you being in the area? I mean, could you guys have
been, absolutely.
If you'd been in Nebraska, could have gone to where it was? Or
not likely. Not likely.
What was the help?
You know, some of these factors have changed since then. But one is that there's a lot of expertise that we got from friends that, let me take it back. You probably could do it from somewhere else, but it was very helpful to us to have friends who work in the same space who could give us a lot of advice. And odds of having those friends are a lot lower if you're not here.
Right.
We're physically here, and these are our friends. You know, like people we went to college with help build big sites.
Right.
And but you know, today on the internet, it's not hard to make friends virtually either. So, you know, it certainly is possible to do these kind of things.
What kind of stuff would be advice that you got from your friends in the Bay Area?
A lot of it was technical.
So scaling it, you mean?
Just scaling it, you know, just infrastructure right. conditions. You know, the Rackspace deal, if I call them, I did call them cold, but I happen to know, I read that Lou Merman went to Stanford Law School the same year as this other guy I knew. So I emailed my friend saying, hey, do you know this guy? He said, yeah, I know him. I'm like, can I mention that I know you?
Right.
He said, yeah. And then I called, so when I cold called them, I said, hey, I know you went to law school with Josh.
Right.
Josh Becker. And hey, so I'm a friend of Josh's. And that was helpful, right?
Right.
You know, like, certainly we could have achieved what we achieved if we didn't live here. But, you know, it's kind of hard to answer the question because I don't know. I don't know what would happen if we lived in Nebraska.
But you didn't raise money. You didn't have a board.
Yeah.
I mean, you just had friends that helped pull through stuff.
Yeah. And if we didn't have that help, I can't say maybe we would have been successful still. And there certainly are companies that are successful that are not in the Bay Area.
Mm.
But, you know, it's kind of like when people ask me, did I get anything out of business school? Like, I can't really tell you what I got out of business school. Like, my answer to that, you know, would probably be not really. But I can't really say. Maybe I did. Maybe there's some intangibles that I learned or developed skills that I, you know, that I have that became useful. That it's hard to say what the world would be like if we took a different path because
right.
I don't know.
Right. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now? I mean, you're an angel, you're doing stuff, you're
yeah,
all the things.
Yeah,
like
I started angeling things about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So Mochi Media is probably the biggest one I'm in. Slide.
Your name is Trent Slide?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, Slide. I'm best friends with Matt Levchin, who's the founder of Slide, and because we were all in Mountain View, and so we were close to PayPal, and that's how I met him, through PayPal connection. Slide started off as Baby Ticker, and it was a product that was going to show you pictures of... it's basically an RSS image feed reader, and the first feed that he offered was a hot or not hot girl feed that we created for him. So yeah, Slide and a company called Raptor that Dennis Fong does. I don't know if you know Dennis. He just started. He was one of the founders of Xfire, which was a
right, yeah.
gaming. So he's doing a new thing in gaming called Raptor. I was involved with BitTorrent. And I'm like probably in like 10 companies or so. I started doing that. Thinking that maybe that could be my career.
Right.
I come to the realization lately that I'm not sure if I'm ready to be just an investor because I kind of miss the adrenaline.
Mm-hmm. What 10 hours a week?
Well, no, obviously not the adrenaline of working 10 hours a week, but the adrenaline of having something that is worth working 10 hours a week on.
Right.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, 10 hours a day on. No, sorry.
You had it pretty good.
No, we've been very lucky, but I miss the adrenaline of having something and having... the creation aspect of it
right.
is very valuable to me. You know, I always like building things, and you know, when I was a kid, you know, I went from being with Legos and programming to, you know, like I feel internet services are things. You know, like they're not physical things, but they are meaningful to people. So I enjoy making things that people like, and I get a rush out of it.
Mm.
And so I think my goal now is probably to go back to starting something.
Will you do it from the site?
You know, like so, I'm going to take this vacation for a year,
mm-hmm.
and. And my wife just had a kid, and so it's kind of like, it's pretty clear that I'm not going to get much work done over the next year anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So might as well go travel, you know, not just sit at home all day.
You can travel with a kid?
Yeah, I'm told that it's actually easier in the beginning. So, yeah, because he sleeps a lot.
Yeah.
And it gets harder when they start running around.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I'm going to take this year to come up with ideas and think of different things. And then when I get back, probably get to work on some of them.
Mm.
I find that, like, a lot of things... a lot of the better ideas, there's not really a big hurry. Because odds of anyone implementing, thinking of something really innovative and executing on it too at the same time, like within a year time frame, is pretty low. And that most good ideas can simmer for years. And actually, good ideas are the ones that stick.
What's an example of ideas? Because my feeling has been that the good ideas go at a certain time, and once they go on.
Well, yeah, timing is almost everything for a lot of things, right? And a lot of times people who think of ideas think ahead of the curve. Like a lot of the really big ideas are things that are ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know, with Hot or Not, we happened to launch right around the time that digital cameras were getting cheaper.
Right.
And so more people could participate, and that made it infinitely more viral.
Mm.
Because, you know, I mean, usually it would be... The content creation aspect of it drives a lot of the growth.
Mm.
So, I just realized I have 3 o'clock. Am I late?
No, you're fine.
Okay, 45. Okay. Sorry. And so, you know, the timing for us was the content creation piece. YouTube as well. Like, right around when YouTube came out, that's when cameras started having the ability to create videos.
That makes sense.
And things like that. So I think oftentimes ideas are ahead of their time. And it kind of wait. You have to wait for the technology that it relies on to get cheap and widely distributed.
So can I ask what you're looking at?
Oh, I mean, I'm not looking at anything right now, but I do think about like these kinds of issues. Like what's down the pipe? Like, I think a good way to think about these things are to think of what technology, what is the future going to look like? What's going to be different? Like, for instance, right now, I can tell you that the iPhone is changing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily that everyone's going to be on the iPhone, but the use case and the paradigm in which people think of their level of connectivity with an iPhone is going to change how all smartphones are made.
And so if you do a consumer app space around it, the iPhone's going to be in a year or two or three.
Well, yeah, so then you start thinking about things like the concept of ubiquitous connectivity. Mm. Like the fact that I'm going to be connected 100% of my day, and not just when I'm at a computer or even my laptop, mm. right? Like, and the fact that it has push notifications now is insanely huge, right? So you start thinking about, well, with that infrastructure, when everyone has the ability to be connected, to be contacted 24 hours a day with connectivity like that, what can you do now,
right?
Right? And the truth is that, like, if you think of that, you're going to be early because everyone doesn't have connectivity. Right. Everyone doesn't have an iPhone now, right?
And then it's not after that.
Right. But you know, the truth is that people have been thinking about that concept for almost a decade now, right? Before it was with app.
Right.
But it's clear that the paradigm shift just happened. And so a lot of ideas that people probably had 5 to 10 years ago are only now possible, right? And so I don't really feel that, like, it's, like, you know, I think when I'm traveling, I can think about ideas that may be the right time when I get back, or mm-hmm. maybe a little later. You know, in Hadronaut, we had the idea for Hadronaut, the general idea of Hadronaut we had a year and a half before we launched Hadronaut. Mm-hmm. It was basically a dating site that we would use collaborative filtering and things like this.
Right.
But it wasn't interesting until people had the ability to take their own photo and submit their own photo to that system, right? And so that's why the time was right.
But you didn't know that.
We didn't know. It wasn't thought out, but the fact is, more people had cameras. So it's not that we thought, hey, we're going to wait until cameras are out that we'll launch it.
Right.
But, you know, this is like, because cameras are starting to come out, you start thinking about pictures again. And it's like, oh, yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, right.
No, so it's not like master evil. It's not like evil plan. You know, like genius. It's not a genius plan, but you just notice things. And, like, the timing is right when the idea comes back to you, because it's coming back to you for a reason.
Yeah, right.
Based on some external suggestion factor, right? Like, oh, shit, everyone has cameras now.
Got it. Just quickly, Johanna, what are you doing now? Is he going to be part of the next venture?
He's in Philly now. Mm-hmm. He still has a house here, so he goes back and forth. But his wife's from Philadelphia, so they moved out there. And he's just kind of, he's just working, he's going iPhone nuts now, out of his house, just him.
Cool. On to the next thing.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to talk about if we haven't covered?
No. I mean, yeah.
Cool.
I don't have an agenda, so if you ask, I'll answer it. But,
no, that's it. Well, thanks.
Thank you.